Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, listeners. I just wanted to let you know that I have uploaded Premium Series 29 Part 4 to the Premium subscription, and that includes lots of listen and repeat pronunciation drills. So I've taken target language from Part 3 of Premium Series 29, and there are lots of pronunciation drills, so sentences including the target language, and the idea is that you listen and try to repeat exactly the way I'm saying those sentences, and we focus on sentence stress, word stress, connected speech, and weak forms as well. So if you ever want to listen to me say some sentences and then repeat after me and work on your pronunciation, you can do that with Premium episodes. So check out Premium Series 29 Part 4. It's available to all the Premium subscribers now. And if you would like to sign up to Luke's English Podcast Premium to access all of those episodes, then just go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info. Hello, listeners. This is a podcast for learners of English as a foreign language or learners of English as a second language. And if you are a learner of English, hello. Thank you for choosing to listen to my podcast. If you're a regular listener, if you're a Lepster, as you're known, then hello. Welcome back to the podcast. Are you ready for some English listening practice? I hope so. But yes, this is a podcast for English language learners. And for that reason, before we get to the actual interview, I will do an introduction to explain certain things. So why am I saying this bit? Well, I'm aware that I might be speaking to some people who don't normally listen to this podcast in this episode, because I've got, you know, a guest in this episode that might attract some other listeners. And, you know, that might include Applejack's fans or perhaps some of Megan's friends and family. Hello, if that is the case. Hello, it's me. It's Luke. Hello, I might know you. I hope you're doing all right. I probably haven't seen you for a long time. Long time no see. Anyway, what I'm trying to say here is that there is a fairly long introduction to this before we actually listen to Megan speaking. And because my listeners are generally people learning English around the world, sometimes I have to explain certain things in advance in order to help them. You know, that's the whole point. They're learning English. And that includes things like cultural references, bits of UK general knowledge, and also specific vocabulary. And that's what I am doing in the introduction to this. So if that's not for you and you'd rather just skip straight to Megan, then you can skip forwards to about 24 minutes in. Okay. For the usual listeners, hello to all of you, wherever you are on planet Earth at this moment. Hello to all my Lepsters. So for all the Lepsters, I suggest that you keep on listening and you do listen to the introduction, because I'm going to explain some things that I think that you need to know, and that will help you get the most out of the episode. All right. So if you want to skip straight to Megan, go to about 24 minutes in, or maybe 25 minutes in. Otherwise, just keep listening. Okay. Right. You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Okay, so let me tell you a few things about the episode that you're going to hear. I'm going to try and keep this introduction as short as possible, but there are some things that I feel I need to tell you just to give you enough context and, you know, vocabulary and bits of general knowledge for you to properly understand this conversation, or at least to help you to do that. So in this episode, you're going to listen to me in conversation with Megan Brady, who was a pop star in the 1960s, yes, a proper pop star. She was in a band which had a top 10 single. She was on the radio. She appeared on a lot of the music TV shows in the UK. She met loads of other pop stars of the moment, including the Beatles. Yes, she met the Beatles. And in fact, John Lennon and Paul McCartney gave her band a song which they recorded. That was their second single, actually. The band were featured in the music magazines, and no doubt many teenagers all over the country had Megan's photo on their bedroom walls. yeah, proper pop star stuff. So this is the story of Megan's career in music in the 1960s. Now, you might be thinking, which band was Megan in? Well, the band was called the Applejacks. You might not have heard of them. They're not one of the big bands that we now think of when we look back at the 1960s, and they didn't really reach fame on an international level, but they were certainly part of the scene and were well known at the time. My mum was a fan of the Applejacks, for example. Of course, we know about the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and other groups, but there was a whole wave of other groups from all over the UK who were playing a new form of music, and so many young people were really into it, and that includes the Applejacks, who were from the Birmingham area. My guest is Megan Brady, as I've said, although she was known as Megan Davies in those days. And Megan was the bass player, the bass guitarist in the band. And at that time, it was quite uncommon to have a female musician in a group. We're talking about the early to mid-1960s. There were female singers, but you hardly ever saw girls actually playing instruments in bands. And so that was one of the unique things about the Applejacks. So yes, you're going to hear Megan talking about all of this, as well as other details like her other career as a clinical physiologist in neurophysiology in the National Health Service. So that's the other work that she's been doing over the years. And being a clinical physiologist in neurophysiology basically involves studying people's brain waves, okay? And also we talk about just stuff about playing the bass guitar and how she's been working on her technique and things like that. So I know Megan because I'm mates with one of her sons, Jake. I'm friends with one of her sons, Jake, or Jacob, as she calls him. I met Jake at sixth form college when I was about 16, and we played music together in bands over the years. And I was always really impressed by the fact that Jake's parents were both professional musicians. His mum and his dad as well, in fact, played music professionally. And I was impressed by that because I was so into music from the 60s and 70s at that time, and I still am, including a lot of the artists that Jake's mum and dad had worked with or brushed shoulders with over the years. For example, I was really into Jimi Hendrix. I mean, I'm assuming that most of you know who Jimi Hendrix is. There will be some people out there who are like, Jimmy what? Jimmy who? Jimi Hendrix. I mean, Google it. It's the best I can say. A guitar hero. One of the, you know, most guitarists agree that he's one of the greatest guitarists ever. Anyway, I was really into Jimi Hendrix when I was 16 or 17, and I remember talking to Jake about Hendrix, and he told me that they actually had Jimi Hendrix's wah-wah pedal at their home somewhere. So a wah-wah pedal is just a kind of guitar pedal, something you plug your guitar into in order to change the sound. So yeah, it's like, yeah, hey, you like Jimi Hendrix? Check this out. We've got Jimi Hendrix's wah-wah pedal at home. Come over, I'll show it to you. And I was like, what? So I don't think Jake was bragging about that. I think he thought it was cool too, and he just wanted to share it with me, and I believed him. So that was amazing. Also, I went to Jake's house one day, and I was hanging out in his bedroom, listening to some of his music, and his mum's bass guitar was sitting there, a nice Fender jazz bass. And I picked it up and played it a little bit. And Jake said to me, oh yeah, Jimi Hendrix played that bass once. And I couldn't believe it. Like, Jimi Hendrix played the same bass that was actually in my hands. And it turned out that Jake's mum knew Hendrix a bit back in the old days. And he once had a little go on her bass guitar. And the very same one that was in Jake's bedroom that time. So, yeah, there you go. Wow, that's my claim to fame, listeners. I have played the same guitar as Jimi Hendrix. Now, this is all well and good. I mean, I don't mean to, like, drop names. I'm impressed by that. But, I mean, obviously, Jimi Hendrix, just a normal person like everyone else. Kind of normal? Not really. Anyway, eventually, I learned more, and my parents told me more about Megan and that she'd played bass in the Applejacks in the 60s, and they were one of the popular groups of the time. And so anyway, that's how I know Megan. I'm friends with her son, and now I've finally taken the initiative to interview her on this podcast. And Megan is lovely, and she was happy to do this, which I really appreciate. So I hope you enjoy listening to this conversation and just, you know, enjoy finding out about a period of British history. And just, you know, I hope you find it interesting, the story of getting into a pop band and then having some measure of success. It's not every day that you get first-hand accounts of this kind of thing. So I feel glad that I've spoken to Megan, and you know, I feel thankful that she was willing to share her experiences with us on this podcast. Now, before we start, I just need to explain a few words that you will hear, but that you might not know. A few little reference points just to help you as you listen to this conversation, okay? Because, you know, if you don't have all the general knowledge, if you don't know everything about the culture of the period or certain things in music or like guitar stuff, then you might get a bit lost. So I'm just going to teach you a few little things, just explain a few little things just to help you. So the first thing is the Scouts. Okay, the Scouts. So the Scouts is a worldwide movement for young people. It used to be just boys, but these days it's for boys and girls, I think. And it was founded as the Boy Scouts in England in 1908 by Lord Baden-Powell with the aim of developing character and responsibility. Now, my brother and I used to be Scouts, and my dad also was in the Scouts when he was a child. Young person. So basically the Scouts is kind of like a youth club, and it's something that young people do probably on a weekly basis. So when I was younger, my brother and I would go to Scouts every week, and at Scouts you would learn basic skills and they would kind of encourage you to develop certain kinds of skills, like practical skills. There was an emphasis on being helpful in the community. And the sorts of skills you would learn were, you know, basic practical things like, especially stuff related to being outdoors, like map reading, tying knots, how to start a fire. I mean, the sort of useful fires that you would use when camping, not just how to burn stuff. I mean, anyone knows how to do that. But, you know, how to start a fire when you're outdoors and other things. And you would learn skills and what, and you'd earn badges, which would be attached to your, shirt. You wore a kind of Scouts uniform. So that's the Scouts, a kind of club that involved activities and adventurous stuff, and it was good fun. And the point is about the Scouts is that you'll hear Megan mention the Scouts. She was associated with the Scouts. She was in the Scouts. She was a Cub Scout leader or a Cub Scout mistress, which is someone who organizes Cub Scout activities or monitors groups of Cub Scouts. The Cub Scouts were the younger kids, probably between the age of about 8 and 10 or 8 and 11. That's the Cub Scouts. So the younger ones. And so Megan was a Cub Scout mistress, and she would sort of look after groups of Cub Scouts. Okay. So she was in the Scouts. And in fact, the other members of the Applejacks were also in the Scouts, and that's how they met each other. In fact, they met because the group of Scouts that she was part of put on a gang show. So a gang show is basically a performance by a group of Scouts or Cubs, okay? Probably done at the end of the year, maybe at Christmas or something. So the gang show, yeah, done by groups of Scouts. And it would involve like musical performances or maybe putting on some kind of theatrical performance. And members of the community would come and see the gang show, the parents of the Scouts, like a big performance by all the Scouts. That's a gang show. Okay, I've mentioned Cub Mistress, Scout Hut. Scout Hut is where the Scouts meet, and it could be just any kind of appropriate large space. Sometimes Scout Huts are actually, you know, built to be Scout Huts, like specifically, but otherwise Scouts could meet in community centres or church halls or sports halls, but generally a place where Scouts meet would be a Scout Hut. Okay, moving on. We've got the word skiffle. So skiffle is actually a really important musical movement from the late 50s and probably the early 60s in the UK. And before rock and roll music, which was generally played on electric instruments, electric guitars, skiffle was the thing that young people were really into. It was a hugely popular musical movement, and loads of young people got into skiffle, meaning little groups, little bands, playing skiffle music. So skiffle music was pretty much a mixture of like folk music and country music and maybe traditional jazz music, simple songs played on the guitar. And it was a kind of a simple grassroots kind of music. And it would involve guitars. So kids who had even like basic guitars, acoustic guitars, They would play singing, acoustic guitars, maybe a banjo or a ukulele in there or something like that. So anyway, a skiffle group, a very, very basic early musical craze before the electric guitar craze came in and before the Beatles and stuff. And any group from the 60s, in fact, any sort of guitarist or famous guitarist who became famous in the 60s or even early 70s, almost all of them started by playing skiffle. Okay, so that's skiffle, and skiffle numbers would be skiffle songs. Okay, next is the Shadows. So the Shadows is worth mentioning because the Shadows were a really influential group and maybe the most popular group in the country before the Beatles properly arrived on the scene. And the Shadows played electric instruments. So this was like, so the, for many people, the first introduction to electric guitars, like seeing the Shadows perform and listening to their records. And the lead guitarist of the Shadows was called Hank Marvin. He played a red Fender Stratocaster, which was significant because for many people, this was the first time they'd seen a Fender Stratocaster, which is a beautiful electric guitar. Fender Stratocasters are everywhere now. Everyone's got, I've got one. But in those days, they were very rare and exotic things. And so the Shadows played instrumental guitar music. They sometimes performed with a singer called Cliff Richard, who was also a really big star of the time before the Beatles arrived. He was the kind of like the English Elvis sort of thing. But the Shadows are really known for instrumental guitar songs, really popular, the first electric guitar band that most people got into. Hank Marvin was the first English guitar hero. So there you go. That's the Shadows. Okay, another thing is a cruise ship. So a cruise ship is a big luxury boat, big luxury ship that takes passengers to different holiday destinations. And if you go on a cruise, it would mean instead of like going to a specific location for your holiday, like going to Spain or, you know, somewhere even more exotic, like going to the Caribbean and just staying in one place, you could go on a cruise ship. I think you probably know they're still very, very popular. And cruise ships are these big ships that take passengers to different holiday destinations. And the cruise ships are well equipped with lots of entertainment. They have swimming pools. They have sports facilities. They have restaurants, bars, theatres, casinos, cinemas, and facilities for live music. So like dance halls. And in the 60s, certainly the sort of mid to late 60s, cruise ships run by companies like Cunard Cruises. Cunard Cruises were, that was the big company, the big British company that did cruises from the UK. They would employ bands to perform rock and roll music or pop music to the passengers. And the Applejacks were one of the groups that were employed by cruise ships. And they performed on the Queen Mary and the QE2. And the Queen, these, both of these ships, the Queen Mary and the QE2, or the Queen Elizabeth II, are really sort of well-known flagship British ocean liners. Okay? All right. Next thing is the TV show Top of the Pops. Top of the Pops was a sort of TV institution. And basically, Top of the Pops was a TV show where you could watch your favorite musicians performing on TV, and they would choose the top 10 singles, the top 10 songs of that week, and they would feature those songs often with live performances or at least kind of partially live performances in the studio. So it was a chance for the nation to sit down and watch their favorite pop stars on TV every week. Top of the Pops. Another thing is Great Ormond Street Hospital. Okay, Great Ormond Street is a famous hospital in London specializing in pediatric care. Pediatric care means medical care for children. This is where Meghan has worked since the late 1990s at Great Ormond Street. So we're nearly done here. I just feel like I need to mention some bass guitar stuff. And just a heads up for you, things will get a little bit geeky and specific sometimes in this conversation as we talk about playing the bass guitar, different types of bass guitar, and Meghan's bass playing technique. You know, I know that this stuff about bass guitar playing and different bass guitars, it's a little bit specific, and many of you, that's not your area of interest. But I didn't really want to cut those parts out of the conversation because I personally find those things really interesting. Megan was enthusiastic about them. And so who's to say that you won't find them interesting too? So, you know, I hope that you enjoy listening to us talking about bass guitar stuff. I should just use this as a chance to teach you some things about a bass guitar. So the bass guitar is the one that plays the low notes, the bass notes. Doom, 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 right? That's your bass guitar. It's like, it looks pretty much like a normal electric guitar. It's just bigger. And it's got four strings on it. And the strings are thicker, making those deep notes. Okay, here are some words for the parts of the guitar. At the very top, you've got the head of the guitar. And that's where the name of the guitar is printed. Like, you know, Fender Jazz Bass. Fender is one of the companies, one of the most famous companies that makes guitars. There's Fender and Gibson. We're talking about Fender here. So there's the head of the guitar. There's the machine heads and tuning pegs. These are the things you use to control the tone or pitch of the strings. You can use them to tighten the strings or loosen the strings. So you'll see when guitarists tune their guitars, they're turning the tuning pegs. Okay, and that tightens the strings or loosens them. The machine heads and tuning pegs. Then you've got the neck of the guitar. That's the long section, the neck. And the neck is attached to the body of the guitar. And on the body, you will see like volume and tone controls, little dials that you can turn to, you know, raise and lower the volume and change the tone. And also you'll see pickups on the guitar. Pickups are the things that make the guitar electric. They pick up the vibrations of the metal strings and transform that into a sort of electrical signal. And then when you plug your guitar in to an amp, the pickups are the things that, you know, yeah, turn the strings vibrations into actual electric sound, which can then be amplified and stuff like that. So those are the pickups. And on bass guitars, often they are like little black plastic rectangles that are fitted to the body. And they sometimes have little metal dots on them. And they kind of use electromagnets sort of thing. I don't really understand how they work. But they are very important for guitars. And different types of pickups will generate slightly different sounds. And the position of the pickups also will give a different sound. Okay. Then there's the scratch plate, which is a kind of plastic plate which is put on the guitar to protect it from damage. Especially if you're using a pick. A pick is a little plastic thing that you hold between your thumb and your forefinger, and guitarists will use the pick to strike the strings. Bass players sometimes use their fingers or sometimes use a pick. Okay, you need to put the pick somewhere if you're not using it. So where do you put it? Megan sticks her pick underneath the scratch plate. She kind of like wedges it under the scratch plate. And you'll hear her talk about this because we talk about her guitar and the way that it's got different bits of damage and scratches and bits where the paint has worn off. And if you've ever seen an old electric guitar, one that's seen a lot of action, you'll know what I mean, that some guitars develop a certain unique character in the way that they get worn away. The paint gets worn away in some spots and the wood gets exposed, and those things sort of tell a story of how that guitar has been used over the years. And Megan's Fender Jazz Bass is a great example of this. Finally, then, two types of Fender bass guitar. You'll hear us talking about Fender Jazz Basses and Fender Precision Basses. And for most normal people, these two types of electric bass guitar look almost exactly the same. They're almost identical, really, to the untrained eye. There are just certain little differences, and that's to do with the pickups, the types of pickup that they have, the position of those pickups, and certain other things like the shape of the neck of the guitar. On a jazz bass, the neck is a little bit slimmer. But that's more or less it. So anyway, in any case, if you know anything about electric bass guitars, you'll know that Fender bass guitars are probably the most popular ones. And there are two types of people in the world, two types of Fender bass guitarists. There's Fender jazz people and Fender precision bass people. Although most of us would like to have both, but that's not always possible because, you know, they can be quite expensive. Right. So without any further ado, let's listen to Megan Brady talking about playing the bass guitar and her story of being a pop star in the 1960s. And to lead us into this, I'm going to play a little sample of the Applejacks' first and most successful single, which was called Tell Me When, in 1964. So here we go. Tell me when. Megan, hello.
Hello.
Nice to talk to you.
Good to see you again, Luke.
Good to see you too. Thanks for agreeing to talk to me on the podcast.
It's a pleasure.
I was just saying that actually I've always wanted to ask you all about your life in music, and you know, you were always like my friend's mum, like the coolest mum of all of our friends. And the more we found out about things you'd done as a musician, the sort of cooler and cooler you became. So doing my podcast, I've always wanted to, you know, there's lots of people I've always wanted to talk to, and having a podcast kind of gives me an excuse to do it. I probably should have just asked you in the past when I was around at your house and things like that. But so thanks very much for doing this. Where shall we start?
Well, it was a very, very long time ago, Luke.
Yeah.
I mean, we are talking 1960s, so yes, a long, long time. Today, I'm at home in London, and it's looking a bit murky out there today, is it? Yeah. And it's going to rain, apparently, for the next 6 days. So my situation is, I work currently at a place called Young Epilepsy in Surrey, and I am a clinical physiologist in neurophysiology, which basically, when people sort of quiz me on that, I say, well, I stick wires on children's heads and I record their brain activity. So that's the obvious way to describe it. I'm furloughed at the moment, which means I'm not allowed to get in touch with the establishment at all. I have to stay at home. And I'm due back on the 6th of April. I think as far as that's concerned, it was probably a money-saving thing from Young Epilepsy, because I'm quite expensive and they've saved my wages because the government have been paying them for the last 2 months. Mm. So that's it. I'm here in London and I'm confined. I'm not really supposed to go out at all unless it's for exercise or to go to the shops. So
how have you actually been keeping yourself entertained during the lockdown?
Now that's an interesting question. On May the 17th last year, I discovered Scott's bass lessons. I'm going to sound as if I'm doing an advert here, because it's just taken over my world. It's just so exciting. I've never really practiced very much. I just sort of pick up the bass and it just goes. So I've worked quite hard on trying to get my technique together and trying to read music and lots and lots of exercises. And this Scott Devine is a marvelous fellow who just is so enthusiastic, a great teacher. And he says that there's 27,000 bass players from all over the world. And now I don't know whether that means people who have enrolled and who've dropped off, but 27,000 bass players. That's amazing.
In his program.
In his program. And he does say that it's the best bass guitar. No, not just bass guitar, but it's the best music program in the world. And it probably is, because it's absolutely wonderful. There's a seminar every Monday evening. Some bass player, usually from America, but some from Great Britain, they come on and they've got an hour slot. And so there's that. But there's a lot. Well, I can't begin to tell you what's in the program, because it's just absolutely marvelous. There's lots of things. And you submit videos. And then every month, if you've submitted something, he actually goes through it. And he spends about 20 minutes or half an hour saying how you can improve yourself on the little bit that you've submitted. And it really is very good indeed. And there are people from all over the world, a lot of people from France, people from, well, absolutely every place, you know, Haiti, all sorts of funny little islands that you would never have imagined. Quite a few from Brazil have just come in lately. And it's just very, very good. End of advert.
Yes, there's the plug there for Scott's bass lessons. Well, I know Scott Devine from YouTube, yeah, and he's amazing. But I've never actually joined his program, but maybe I should, because I try to play bass as well. But yeah, you've got to put the time in.
Absolutely.
So just on the subject of bass and your technique and stuff, what is it that you've been working on? Is there something that you feel like you've progressed with since you've been practicing with Scott?
Well, there is something ongoing, which is called the player's path. And there are 9 different levels, and there are about 6 or 8 tunes in each level. And obviously, when you join, you probably start at player's path level 1. And I've got to level 5 so far. And he plays it, and you see the notes, and you see the sort of the tab kind of, and you just play along with it. And you just have to get, you have to be able to play it 3 times perfectly with the right intonation and feel and with the best technique, obviously. And you have to choose 3 of the 6 or 8 pieces. And when you've got 3 of them up to standard, and he keeps telling you that you mustn't cheat, he's very good. He really is very good.
Cheat in the sense of, like, you know, changing the fingering.
Passing before you really have passed, you know. You've got to do it perfectly, and you've got to do it perfectly 3 times in a row before you can move on to the next one. So I've been quite strict, and I've got as far as the 5th one. I don't know how long I'll be on that before I move on. But, of course, you do kind of choose tunes that are more to your own sort of genre and your own feel, your own groove, if you like. That's a word that's used a lot these days. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the heavy metal things, I don't do those because that's not my scene. But, I'm doing a samba at the moment, and something else a bit more sort of funky. I like funky. And so, yeah, it's good.
So it sounds like you're kind of sort of relearning the bass, or at least sort of taking it further than before. But let's go back to when you first picked up an instrument. Can you tell us about how you first got into music?
Yes. I was in a scout gang show. I used to be a cub mistress, and they just said, well, let's have a gang show. Well, let's have a concert. And so... Yeah. There was a situation, well, can anybody play an instrument? And I had a guitar. I couldn't actually play it, but I had a guitar. And 2 other lads had a guitar. The drummer was chosen because he was the lead drummer in the scout band. And so we got together and we did some skiffle numbers. Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley. And... John Henry had a, something, an old Lonnie Donegan, John Henry. It must have been a very old country song. And we played those on the Scout Gang Show. The following year, we did the Scout Gang Show again. And, well, it just snowballed from there. There were 4 of us at that stage. One of the local youth leaders asked us to go and play for his youth group. And so... Little by little, the Shadows, of course, were around at the time.
This is kind of, 1961? Something like that?
Yeah, 60, 61, something like that.
Before the Beatles arrived.
Oh, yes. I think it was 1960 we actually started.
Skiffle was the music that you were playing. That's how you described it.
It was, but we very quickly went electric because it was sort of, you know, the Shadows were doing their thing, and so... The lead guitarist was very much into, I've got to have an electric guitar, and that was it. So he had an electric guitar. The rhythm player, he very soon followed. And I don't know whether anybody actually said this, but it was kind of, well, you're the worst guitarist, Megan, you can play bass. or whether I just chose to do it because I couldn't do all the clever fingering that was needed on a guitar. I always felt that my hands were too... I didn't play guitar very well. So I just stuck on bass. I think to start with, I was actually playing bass on an ordinary sort of acoustic guitar. Anyway, I picked it up and I had a little red Hofner to start with. We all had little red, we all had red Hofners. They were all red and very cheap and yeah.
Hofners would have been like sort of the cheapest, I guess, a version of like a Fender guitar.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Mm.
Something like that, but much more affordable, and they probably sounded pretty bad, but they did the job.
Yes. Right. Well, actually, no, before that, I did have, it was again a Hofner, but I had an acoustic Hofner. That was my first one, and then I moved on to this little red solid one later. Mm.
So when you were playing bass then in the early days, how did you know how to play bass? I mean, were you listening to other people's bass playing, and who were you listening to? Who were your influences?
Well, I suppose it was the same as everybody else's. We were listening to Chuck Berry and Fats Domino and all those people. Obviously, we listened to the Shadows. In fact, what used to happen was a Shadows tune would come out on the Friday, and we'd be there playing it by the Saturday, because Martin, our lead guitarist, was all right into sort of getting it together immediately so that we could go out and be a la dernière mode. It was one of those things, you know. And so we did that. And well, I suppose my thing is really I've got quite a quick ear. And so I just picked it up and played it because I think if you've got a good, quick ear, you just get on and do it. And that, unfortunately, has kind of been a bit of my downfall, because I haven't done a lot of practicing over the years. I've just picked it up, and because of my good ear, I've been able to play. I'm not a bad depth, because I can quickly, if there's a standard, I can just get in and play it just like that, because I've got a quick ear. But to the detriment of my technique, because my technique isn't very good.
That's interesting. So like your musical talent, maybe you sort of like sat on your musical talent a little bit and just sort of relied on the talent. And yeah, now you're working on the technique with Scott.
A bit late.
Okay. So an old acoustic Hofner bass, and then the electric Hofner bass.
Yes.
But I mean, the bass guitar that I know of yours is that Fender, that 60s Fender jazz bass.
Yes, well,
are we getting ahead of ourselves here? There were a couple of
basses in between. I did have a jazz bass probably in 62, and I made that recording of Tell Me When, the hit record. I made that on the jazz, that first jazz bass, but then everyone was going for the. Well, it was a Gibson guitar. The boys had Gibson 335s, and I mm-hmm. had what was called an Epiphone Rivoli, which was the same sort of style. And it did come out of the Gibson factory, but it was called an Epiphone. And so I did for probably three years, I did play that. And I don't know why I left it so long to get back to Fender, because I mean, I've always adored a Fender Jazz. I can't really explain why I didn't get back to the Fender Jazz. But in 1967, I bought the Lady That You Know, the dear Fender Jazz. And I've got others. I've got a Sandberg, I've got a fretless, I've got one of those funny jack things with the end cut off, I've got acoustic one.
I had one of those jack guitars. Yeah,
that's in France. Yes, that's in France, actually.
You know who else has got those? Robbie, Jake's cousin, who used to.
That's the one I've got.
Oh, you've got it, because he used to collect them. So this is, wait a minute, this is your, I guess, nephew-in-law, right?
Yes.
I was in a few different bands with him.
Yes.
And he was always the bass player. And he had a black Hofner jack, headless, and a red one. And I used to have this kind of natural wood one. And I told him, hey, I've got one of those. And he said, oh, can I buy it from you? So I sold it to him because he started collecting them. So I don't know which one you've ended up with.
Okay. I have the red one.
Okay. Right. So I guess I don't know where the black and the wooden ones have gone.
Well, we're still in touch with Robbie, and he is now a drummer, actually.
Is he?
Yes, he's mainly a drummer.
Well, that's funny, because now I've played more bass than drums, so I guess we switched.
Well, he still does play bass, but he's in a Christian band playing drums. They're called Dissident Prophet, and he's quite active. And he does play and sing regularly in a little church in Marston Green.
That's great. Lovely. All right, so you did the Scout Gang show. When you were working with the Scouts, you were a cub mistress, you were playing skiffle, and that's, I guess, when the band sort of got formed. And then did you decide, okay, we're a group now, let's continue doing this? And what happened after that?
Well, what happened then later, we used to rehearse in the Scout Hut, and we used to be doing all these shadows things. And this annoying friend would come along and play the piano. And he would be up the corner. But he was quite helpful, because he sometimes said, no, it's not that chord. It should be such and such a thing. So he sort of joined the group, because we couldn't get rid of him. And so we were just instrumentals. We didn't have a singer. We didn't have a Cliff Richard. We were just sort of an instrumental group. And so we carried on doing all these things. I suppose we must have sung, because we were doing all these tin men, but it was not decent singing, really. Anyway, the chap who cut the hair of two of the lads, he claimed to be a singer. I don't know whether he actually had done anything, really. But we said, well, come along and let's see how we get on. So he came along to the Scout Hut one afternoon, and we did a few Cliff Richard songs, of course. And he was quite a good-looking fellow, and he was quite outgoing and the right sort of personality to be a front man. So we said, oh, okay. And so he joined. Now, at this time, we weren't called the Applejacks. We went through a couple of names. We were called the Jaguars at some point, and we were called the Cresters at another point. But then we found there were other bands called those names. So we became, his name was Al Jackson. So we became Al Jackson, and the drummer thought of the name Applejacks to go with Al Jackson and the Applejacks, because, you know, by then, Jerry and the Pacemakers, Billy Kramer and Dakotas, a few things like that had come up. So we decided that. But then the Merseybeats, the Swinging Blue Jeans, they didn't have singers. And we thought, well, you know, it's our band. Why are we giving this singer this extra title? And so we cut him out and just called ourselves the Applejacks. I guess this must have been in 1963. So we were just called the Applejacks, just because that name went along with Al Jackson, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I see. And so you were kind of gigging regularly then, I guess, during sort of 62, 63?
Oh, yes. We were just one of the Birmingham bands, as you were when you were with the Ute Club. You were around doing all those gigs. So we were doing whatever gigs were around at the time. Let's see, there was the Moat House Club in Bradford Street. There was the Taboo Club in Sturchley. Oh, and then we did Ma Regan, a lady who was from the Black Country. She had places. She had the Plaza place in Oldbury and the Plaza in Handsworth. And she had the Ritz in King's Heath. And they were places, well, all the local bands would go and play at these venues.
What was the scene like then during those shows?
The Plaza and the Ritz, they were sort of, I suppose you'd call them ballrooms in those days. People wanted to dance to us. That was the main thing. I mean, it was before disco, really. It was what happened before disco. And it was kind of between the rock and roll bebop sort of thing and disco. And people... the dancing really consisted of just sort of jiggling about, apart from the twist, of course. When the twist take up, everybody did that crazy dance. And that was during those years. I think the twist came out about 64, 65, something like that. So people were doing that dance.
So a typical show would have been you guys on stage doing your set and an audience of people all dancing and doing the twist and stuff in front of you. Yeah. And so when did it start to get a bit more serious? I mean, record contracts, that's the next step, isn't it? A recording contract. Do you remember the process of getting a recording contract?
Yes, definitely. There was a place in Solihull, the Civic Hall, and it was a bit odd the way we went on there because some friends of ours had got a gig there and their bass player wasn't able to go. So I went along and played, and because of my quick ear and because they were playing songs that I knew, Shadows, things and that sort of thing, I didn't actually have much time to rehearse with them, but it was just a case of, well, you know, can you come and play? And I went along, and because of my quick ear, I was able to do it. But when I took a look at the Civic Hall, it was huge, and it was bigger than any place I'd ever played in. So I put my gear on the stage, my speaker and that sort of thing, and I was frightened to go on, so I played behind the curtain and had to go on. Uh-huh. It was just because, you know, I couldn't believe it was just so big. It holds about 2,000 people, and, well, it held about 2,000 people. It's gone now. And so I gave our card to a man at the side of the stage because he just got chatting to one of the porters, and he gave it to the manager. And the very next week, a band completely folded. I think they were called the Clippers or something, whatever they were called. But they were due to play the next two Mondays because the manager had started this every Monday hop, or whatever they used to call the dancers those days. So the next week we went and played, and there were about 100 people there. And so we were booked to play the following week. So we knew that, you know, if we could get more people, we might be sort of in with the chance of playing there more frequently. So we were playing every Saturday morning at the local sports track in Tudor Grange. And so we advertised it there, and we told everybody, we told all our friends. There were several schools involved. And this was the point as well. This was another point. Three of the people in the band were still at school. I was nursing. The singer was a hairdresser, and Jerry, the drummer, was in insurance. But we went and played and got lots of people. So we actually managed to get 400 people there the second Monday. So, of course, wow. The manager thought, wow, this is this band must be okay, and booked us again. And so it grew and grew and grew. And then a story got in the newspapers because somebody was trying to climb the drainpipe to get in, because they'd sold out all the tickets and we got to 1,000.
This is at the Civic Hall?
Yes.
In Solihull, okay. So, but it's maybe the biggest, at the time, the biggest venue that you could have been playing in, and started to fill it.
You were filling it, yes.
Mm. And even one person climbing up the drainpipe to try and break into the building to get in and see you.
Well, that was the story that got to the recording contract, because what happens is the major newspapers, they look at the little local ones, and if they think there's a good story, they put it in the big paper, and it got in the Daily Mail. But also the manager of the Civic Hall, his brother-in-law used to be in the Ambrose Band, which was a band from the 20s, I think, something like that. Mm. And he knew a few people in town, people in the recording business. And so he brought Mike Smith from Decca to have a look at us in the Civic Hall. And, of course, the fact that there was a female on the bass guitar did give the band an extra sort of, it was a bit original. So I suppose that was an added sort of reason for us to get noticed.
Yeah, there weren't many female band members in those days, maybe singers, but not really many female musicians.
No, there weren't, no.
What was that like? I mean, was that something that people would comment on, or was it just normal?
Well, people would comment on it. I mean, that was one thing. Wow, there's a girl. Yes, it was very, very different at the time. Some girls who just followed the boys for, you know, good-looking boys in bands were perhaps a bit jealous that there was a girl up there, but most times it was quite accepted. People were surprised, I think.
did you have your fans? Because I guess sort of bands in those days, or even today, in fact, they each member of the band has their own little section of the fandom. Were there Megan fans?
Well, do you know, I didn't know it much at the time, but so many times in the years after the Applejacks, people have said to me, wow, I used to have a picture of you on my bedroom wall. Wow, I thought you were fantastic. So I've heard about that, the my fan following, more since the 60s than I did at the time. But I suppose there weren't, you know, there weren't many girls around in the business then. You know, we did a tour once with Lulu, Millie, the Honeycombs, and Lantree played the drums. And there were four of us in the dressing room. And that was quite fun, having four girls together, because it was a very much a male-dominated sort of society.
That's great. Well, yeah, I know my mum was a fan, and she was so surprised when she learned that I was friends with Megan Davies from the Applejacks' son. It was a bit of a complicated sentence. But when she kind of, I think she picked me up one day from your house. I must have been 17 or 18. And I think maybe my dad or my mom, I can't remember. But they got kind of chatting to you and then worked out who you were. And I think my mum was a bit starstruck because I think she was a fan back in the day. That's nice.
I have a good friend at church right now, actually, who claims that she was just absolutely knocked out. She was from Liverpool. And she was absolutely knocked out when she first saw a girl on stage. And she said it to me many times. Oh, I remember how excited I was to see a girl in there. You know, she's a person who's my age, and she was just thought it was wonderful for females to be represented.
Yeah, absolutely. So what about the record contract then? So you got noticed by the guy from Decca. And did you have to audition for them or something? I mean, what was the process of getting a contract?
No. He'd come and he'd seen us, thought we were worthy of a record contract. And we went down to record things, and we were given, tell me when, they said, I think this would suit your band, play it. You know, we didn't write it ourselves. We were given it and said, this is what you do. The B-side, which was called Baby Jane, we thought was actually better and more our style than Tell Me When, because Tell Me When was a little bit pretty, whereas Baby Jane was a little bit more gritty. But we went along, and we were, I won't say we were totally misrepresented by Tell Me When, but it wasn't, Tell Me When wasn't typical of our set, really. Because our set was more rock and roll-y, Fats Domino, Chuck Berry orientated, the Coasters. So we were, I mean, all bands were doing that at the time. We were copying the American bands, you know.
So your set was more R&B flavoured, and Tell Me When was more of a straight-ahead song.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, how did it feel getting a record deal with Decca? Was it exciting? Was it frightening?
Oh, absolutely exciting, very exciting. We went down to record it in the snow. I remember going down quite well because it was before the M1 was there, but the bottom bit hadn't been made. And so it was going from the bottom, which was probably just after Luton, something like that. It was down the Edgware Road. So it was a totally different way into London. And it was in the snow. And we got to Decca, and I think we went down in the November, and then we went and recorded. No, it came out. Can't remember exactly, to tell the truth. It was a long time ago, Luke.
Yeah, I guess. I guess it's a funny thing of being, especially in the business in those days, I don't know if things have changed that much, but being given a song, and that song, that first song defines how the public sees you as a band.
Yeah.
And there's not always that much control you can have over these things, especially when it's your first single.
And I can go further than that, in that by the time, I think it was the fourth song, Mary Poppins had just come out, and Decca wanted us to record Chim Chim Cheree. Mm-hmm. And we said, don't be so ridiculous. But they really, really wanted to do it. In fact, when you look at some of the discographies, you will see Chim Chim Cheree by the Applejacks actually in some of the lists. Oh, we never did it. We never recorded it. We said, you're joking. We're not going to do that. It doesn't define us. It's silly. We're not going to do it. Yeah. And they were a bit annoyed about that, actually. And so they weren't very helpful after that because, you know, they, I suppose they thought, who does this little stupid band think they are, you know? I guess we just didn't want to be that sort of a band. We weren't, yeah, we were cooler than that.
Yeah, well, of course, Chim Chim Cheree's not very cool at all.
No.
And we know now, looking back, that, yeah, that would have been a, that wasn't really part of the overall musical movement of the time that, that that we now look back on. Okay, but they didn't let you do one of the more R&B flavoured sort of...
Well, we did, rock, after that, things. I think the one after that was, we did I Go to Sleep, which was a Ray Davis thing, Ray Davis from the Kinks. What actually happened to sort of move us out of the limelight was the fact that in 1966, we went on a Cunard cruise. It was an odd thing. It was the News of the World ran a competition for people to go on a Christmas cruise. And it went to the Canary Islands. And there were lots of famous people on it. I remember Joe Davis, the snooker player, and Elizabeth Long, the swimmer, and Max Wall was on it as well. Lots of celebrities were on it. And we were booked to play on it. So we went, and Cunard realized that a pop group was a good idea on a cruise. So we were asked to go back, and we went and played. This was the Queen Mary at that time. Then we went back to play on the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth, and we got stuck on there because it was nice. We enjoyed it. And we played until... I think we played on the QE2, the first voyage, in 1969, I think it was. So we were stuck between 66 and 69 on cruise ships, mainly the Queen Elizabeth, but then later the QE2. And that was, yeah, that just took us out away from the UK scene, you know.
So. I guess, yeah, that was the downside. Like, on the plus side, maybe you've got a good paying job on the QE2, which is pretty great. You know, it's a big cruise liner and very posh and all that stuff.
It was. And, of course, we were absolutely adored because British pop group. We used to go over in October and we'd stay doing cruises for Americans from New York to the Bahamas or the West Indies or Bermuda or something like that. We'd do various cruises until April and then come back in the April. So we did that every year. We would have Christmas Day in Nassau and in Bahamas and things like that. So, wow. Yeah. But one of the great things about that, Luke, was we would get in on a Monday night, and it was we'd be there 2 weeks at a time, every 2 weeks. In the summer, we'd just do crossings. So on Monday nights, every other Monday night, we'd be in New York. And we'd go down to the village, and we quite often would go to the Village Vanguard, where a magnificent jazz band was on. It was Thad Jones' Mel Lewis band, and they were wonderful. And we would be there, and in the front line would be all musicians from the ship. We'd be sitting there eager to listen. And, you know, I was 75 the year before last. And I thought, and my birthday was on a Monday, and I thought, Monday, what can I do on a Monday on this very special day? I thought, I know what I can do. And I went to the Village Vanguard. I booked a holiday in New York, went to the Village Vanguard, and obviously none of the musicians were the same. But I spent a most magnificent night at the Village Vanguard. And there's still a very, very good band there. So it's been there on a Monday night, an excellent band of wonderful musicians. And it was just such a thrill. But it was just about the whole deal was one of the biggest things was going and seeing these magnificent jazz musicians. I mean, one night we were there and Sarah Vaughan got up to have a jam. You know, it was just
wow,
amazing.
So this is sort of like the late 60s,
yes,
I guess. Yeah, mm-hmm. What an incredible time to be able to just drop in to Greenwich Village and see what's going on. Mm-hmm. Now, before you got on the cruise ships, which I guess sort of took you away in a sense, they gave you work and helped you travel, but took you away from the scene. Before you got on the cruise ships, we've talked about the record contract with Decca, but it's probably worth saying that your first single, Tell Me When, that was given to you by the record contract, did well. It got to like number 5 in the Melody Maker chart, number 7 in another chart. Mm-hmm. It did well.
I don't think it got to number 1 in any chart. It definitely got to number 2 in the Decca charts. But in those days, there was a Melody Maker chart and an NME chart and a BBC chart, and Luxembourg, Radio Luxembourg had its own chart. And so it was kind of different in those days. But yes, it did very well.
Cool. Great. What was that like? I mean, do you remember hearing it on the radio for the first time?
Oh, yes. It was amazing. You know, hearing it on the radio for the first time was just so exciting.
Did you get a touch or taste of fame? I mean, obviously, Beatlemania was something completely unbelievable. But a lot of other bands, you know, that were lumped into the British Invasion sort of category of British bands that kind of got successful in the wake of the Beatles. What level of, well, celebrity or fame did you experience?
In those days, I think there was only one TV channel. Maybe the ITV channel had started. But, of course, practically everybody watched Top of the Pops. So if you were on Top of the Pops, everybody knew your face, had seen you. And so I'd go into shops and people would be, oh, you know, that's Megan. It would be one of those things. People would, although I was just in what now seems just another band, I would be recognised because that's the way it was in those days. I recall going up to Scotland and we had a little entourage following us wherever we went, sort of, well, that's the Applejacks, you know, being on television. And a little group of children and teenagers would follow us around wherever we went and wait outside the hotel for us and that sort of thing. Because that's the way it was in those days. And yes, when we did dance halls and things like that, the girls would scream and the boys might get pulled off the stage and that sort of thing. And the Beatlemania thing was, yes, it was the sort of thing all the other bands experienced.
Now, it's not very cool of me to do this, but maybe because it's not cool to like drop names and things, but I feel compelled to ask you about some of the people that you must have met. And I know that your second single was a Lennon and McCartney song. They gave it to you. So did you actually meet the Beatles?
Oh yeah.
I must know everything. I need to know all about what happened.
Well,
can you tell what can you tell us?
In those days you got to meet the other bands at television studios and things like that. Or you know, you went to the Adlib Club or the one of the London nightclubs and mixed there. So yes, we played in Folkestone with the Rolling Stones. I don't think we had any other, I think that was the only time we met them. But the Beatles we met at Rediffusion Studios in Wembley. We weren't doing the same program. We were doing another program. I can't remember what we were doing. But we met them and it was Paul who said, well, yes, do you want, you know, have you got a follow-up? Do you want a song? And we sat with them in the canteen and talked to them. And we went to their dressing room and they talked about, you know, whether they'd got a song. And the way we got the song was a bit... It was one of the songs that they had actually done when they went for their Decca. I'm sure you heard about their Decca interview when.
Yes.
Yeah, Mike Smith was told to choose. He could either have the Tremolos or the Beatles. And he was a London guy and the Tremolos were Cockney kids. He wanted to have both bands and he was told he had to make a selection. And he chose the London guys and, of course, the Beatles. Yeah, so he became famous for turning down the Beatles, poor Mike. He was a lovely guy.
Yeah, I guess it was just one slight lapse of judgment. But that Decca audition that they did is not particularly great. I've heard people talking about it. I've heard it, and they weren't really at their best. I think, you know, they were nervous, and for one reason or another, they didn't really show themselves as being the good band that they were. And they did much better at EMI. But I mean, when you met them, what were they like? I mean, did you get a sense of their personalities? I mean, what kind of interaction did you have?
Oh, yes. I mean, yes, definitely. I mean, I was a little bit in awe of John because he just, he was always so cool, wasn't he? And he'd written that book in his own right. And I just thought, I could feel that he just felt so intelligent that I could hardly dare speak to him. Paul was very pleasant, very outgoing, very welcoming, the PR person. Ringo was quite chatty. We sat at his table in the canteen, and I was a bit, I fancied George Harrison, so I was always a little bit awkward about speaking with him. But Paul was very accommodating, yeah, very.
What did you like about George?
I don't know. You know, when you were a girl, you had to sort of choose one of the Beatles. You had to select one. And I thought, his looks, I suppose, probably.
Mm-hmm. What were they like to chat with? I mean, were they being funny and stuff, or were they a bit exhausted by all the attention?
No, they were quite bouncy, but they were being bombarded by folk. I mean, even I got their autographs because, you know, they were just such special people. So they were busy scribbling autographs most of the time, to tell the truth. They signed my book, and I've also got a separate paper with their autographs on. But they were still full of it and full of enthusiasm for music and what they were doing. Mm.
Great. So you talked about going to America with the cruise ship and stuff. But the Applejacks never actually did any tours in America.
No tours, no. We did a few gigs in New York, just in little clubs, you know, Electric Circus, I think.
So what actually happened then? So after the first single kind of did well, top 10, second single, Lennon and McCartney, surprisingly did less well than the first one, even though it had been given the gold stamp of Beatles approval. It didn't reach the same position as the previous single.
No.
That must have been a bit of a disappointment, I suppose.
I can't remember. We were just so busy enjoying being on the road with the band. I don't know whether it mattered at the time that it didn't get as high. I don't know whether we were following that so much. It was just we were having a great time being on the road.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just playing music, doing what we wanted to do. That's
great. That's the way it should be, I guess. Yeah. And so, I mean, what then happens? Because you know, if you go on Spotify, if you search for the band's music, it seems that there's most of this, well, all the stuff, as far as I can tell, comes from that period of 64, 65.
Yes. Well, of course, when we got on the cruise ships, we got away from it. And we did actually change. We had a new singer by 67, I think it was, because Al left. He was going to go solo, but it didn't work out for him, and so he decided not to. But we got a new singer, John, and he was with us most of the time. And then we did release one thing after that with CBS. It was You've Been Cheating, an old Curtis Mayfield wrote it. And we were getting a bit more into a bit more soul-y, funky type stuff by then. We did go through a little bit of a Beach Boys thing, but then we really, mainly because of the singer, he liked all that Curtis Mayfield stuff. So we got into that sort of soul-y stuff. Yeah, and because we were on the ships, we didn't do any recording. We just stayed on the ships. And it was quite time-consuming because you wouldn't have long between. We had 2 weeks off in the summer. And then whilst another band would go and do the there and back voyages. So we were literally totally tied to working on the ship because, as I said, we'd go out in October, we wouldn't come back till April. And then from April to October, we were just doing crossings, Southampton, New York, Southampton, New York. And so we didn't really have time to do any recording because we were just too busy being seamen.
I've got to ask you for another little story, possibly, and that is, I was talking to you about this before, that when I came round to your house first, when I was friends with Jake and he invited me over, and I was in Jake's room and your bass guitar was there, and I picked it up and started playing it, and Jake casually told me, oh yeah, Jimi Hendrix played that bass. And it's true, Hendrix did play the bass. How did Jimi Hendrix end up playing your Fender Jazz bass then? Which I later played. Now I have the honor of having played the same guitar as Jimi Hendrix. But how did Hendrix pick up that guitar?
Well, it was in my mum's house in Castle Lane in Solihull. And well, the thing was, my brother-in-law, John, he was the roadie with Jimi Hendrix. And so, I mean, he didn't actually play it on stage. He just played it because it was there at the house, you know.
He came to your house.
He came to my mum's house.
He came to your mum's house. Mm-hmm.
But he did once play at the Cedar Club in Birmingham. And because he's left-handed, you see, he couldn't really pick up a lead guitar and just play it just like that. So when he did come to the Cedar Club, he played a bass, but played it kind of upside down, because obviously, you know, he's a great musician and he could play it, but I mean, he couldn't really play my bass because he's left-handed, but on this occasion at the Cedar Club, he got up and he played the bass this way. You know, it must have been difficult for him being left-handed, you know, because he couldn't just get up and play bass left-handed, right-handed when he's left-handed, you know.
Normally he would have had the neck in his right hand and plucking the fingers with his left hand, but he switched it over into, so he was holding the neck in his left hand and not the normal hand. It's amazing. Yeah. Amazing that he could do that.
Actually, he didn't. No, he didn't.
No?
He played it upside down.
Yeah, so he's got the bass string at the bottom and playing it upside down.
Yeah.
Still amazing. I mean, whatever way you do it, it's still pretty amazing. Wow, that's so great. I mean, and how did you find Hendrix? I mean, was he – people said that he's shy, despite the fact on stage he was a lot more outgoing. But
yes, he is. But he was very cool. And just very good. But yes, he was shy. I mean, because he was shy, he didn't say an awful lot. I mean, I didn't have a long conversation with him, really, because he was. Yeah. Quite a shy person. He'd just talk about everyday things. I did meet him once in New York. We were in there and we went up to his room in his hotel. He was in a hotel near Times Square, and we went up there and just chatted generally, you know, no outstanding remarks that I can remember, you know.
Like, oh, the weather's nice today, isn't it, Jimmy? I could keep asking you more and more questions, but I mean, what happened then? Now you work in healthcare and stuff, and so when did you stop doing music and start becoming a nurse and working in the health service and so on?
Well,
if I can ask,
after the Applejack sort of folded in about the last phase was about 71, I suppose. I was in various bands in and around Birmingham. I did lots of different types of bands. I was with one band called Mongrel in Birmingham for quite a long time, and we got quite excited about that band and thought we were going to do something. We've got an album, an Polydor album. But what happened was Roy Wood pinched half the band to go to join Wizard. And so that band, Mongrel, folded, and I was in the sort of second phase of Mongrel. But then there were other bands. Oh, I played with many, many different bands. I did actually, for one summer season, play with the Ivy Benson band, an all-girls band. That was exciting. That was when Jacob was about two at the time, and Luke had just been born. So So that was that was an experience. And that I had to try and read music, which is not my forte. So that was difficult for me. And then I just stayed doing different little things with various bands because the children, it was an easy job to do because I could just get a babysitter for the children and I would be away when the children were asleep. So I'd be working during the evenings, which was good. And I went back in just after Oscar was born in 89. I went back to proper job. I worked in and around Birmingham, various hospitals, and I was at the QE. No, I was at the Queen Elizabeth Psychiatric at the time, doing EEGs, you know. And my husband wanted to move to London because he thought there'd be more opportunity to play music, and he'd been down there working in London in the 70s. And so we moved down to London, and I got a job at Great Ormond Street. Not everybody who does neurophysiology likes to work with children, so you've got to have a little bit of extra patience to work with children and deal with their parents. And so I moved down to Great Ormond Street, and so we've been down in London ever since. And when I retired, I wasn't at the Great Ormond Street then. I did move to Queen's Square to work with adults. But then when I tried to retire, my consultant from Great Ormond Street said, well, will you come and work down here? I said, how can I work down there in Surrey when I live in North London? So we made this arrangement for me to go down 3.5 days a week. And I've been doing that ever since. I went to help out for a couple of weeks. And I'm still there.
12 years later, still there.
Yeah.
So I guess during the 70s and 80s, I guess maybe the 80s, as well as being a musician on the side, you were training to become a clinical physiologist as well.
Something that I'd already done. It was the only thing I knew, really, because that's what although I went initially to be a nurse, I was put in the EEG department by way of discovering all the different things that were going on in the hospital. And I got stuck there. I got fascinated by looking at brain activity. And a lady was just about to leave to have a baby. So I was in the right place at the right time.
This is the 70s,
is it? This is the 60s. Because I was in EEG before I went professional with the band.
Right,
so I
see.
I was already not just a little nurse. I was already, they called me an EEG recordist at the time, rather than a clinical physiologist.
Was this university did you go through university to?
I was just in the right place at the right time. I just fell into it. I went to train as a nurse, but after going into that particular department and realizing my...
Your preference
preference. Well, one, you have to be able to understand the activity, and it was something that not everybody can do. You've got to have an artistic, perhaps, tendency to be able to identify the brain activity and its changes.
So you just had a sense of how to understand and how to observe and look at brain activity. I guess it was just a skill that you had
to start with. You look at the wavy lines and you think, wow, that's fascinating. And you get to know it a bit more and because I was a nurse just observing, I thought, wow, that's fascinating. And this lady just had left to have a baby just whilst I was there. And so, although I hadn't got the qualification, in those days, there wasn't so much university going on, you know? So they realized my potential, I suppose, and sort of said, well, yes, come and work with us.
So finally, I just want to ask you about your bass guitar again, which is next to you as we speak, because you've been practicing.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful to see it because it's one of these instruments, one of these guitars that's got lots of patches on it where the paint has come off and the wood is being exposed underneath, which shows where you put your thumb.
Exactly.
When you play, you stick your thumb on the body of the guitar.
Oh, and that's probably I've got to change that as well. He says my thumb, it's not anchored. That was one of Scott's points about me. My thumb is not anchored. And so because it wasn't anchored and it was sort of floating about here, I now have got to rest it on the
pickup
and play like that.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about a Fender Jazz is that it has these two pickups in two positions, and it's really convenient for just resting your thumb.
Yeah.
You can just stick your thumb on the end of either pickup and get a different sound. Mm-hmm. So why the jazz bass then? Why? I mean, you said that you'd had different basses during your career and stuff, but what is it about the Fender Jazz that's so great?
Well, this is the thing. If you were to go into Scott's bass lessons, you would realize that there are the jazzers and the P basses, and never the twain shall meet.
I've got a P bass over there.
Have you? Well, Scott.
Yeah, hold on. I need
Scott,
to show you. Hold on.
Scott is crazy about P basses.
You'll see it's new.
Oh, very nice.
Whoops. You'll see it's new. I got it during lockdown. It's a Mexican made P bass.
Oh, lovely.
I've got the
very
same,
shiny.
It's extremely shiny and no wear and tear on it at all, almost. It's never been out of the apartment. But I've got the rubber band because sometimes I try and stick the rubber band over the strings at the top to try and, you know, deaden, muffle them a bit. You can also put the little sponge underneath the strings here at the bridge. But, yeah, P bass, so the same tortoise shell plus sunburst that you've got.
Yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted you, but you were talking about how in Scott's bass lessons you understand that there are the jazz bass people and the Fender precision bass people.
Absolutely.
But you always went for the jazz bass.
Initially, it was because of neck, because at the end of the neck here, it's narrower this way in depth. And so I found it easier to play. But since then, I've got used to the tone and the sound, and I prefer the tones that you can get with the jazz than the precision. But I mean, Marcus Miller is totally jazz. Scott is totally P bass. Well, people tend to choose either the P bass people or the jazz bass people. Jaco is a jazz person, you know, and so in fact, I was looking at a thing of Jaco, and he's got one of these. He's got that. So he must have done a bit of that sometimes.
You mean he's got a patch of exposed wood where he's placed his thumb?
It's not until fairly recently that I've realised that that's what it is. It's me putting my thumb there instead of resting it on the thing. And here, I keep my plaque there. So look, a little mark has come around there.
So there's what listeners. What Megan is describing here is that there's a place where the scratch plate meets the body of the guitar, just above the neck, and that's where she slides her plectrum to keep it there. Plectrum is the little plastic thing that you use to strike the string sometimes, and there's even a patch where the paint has come away just from putting the plectrum in and removing it so many times over the years. It's lovely the way guitars pick up these marks and these patches and stuff. And
I used to smoke. Your cigarette used to go.
So Megan, listeners, is now pointing to a spot at the end, at the top end of the guitar, where the neck meets the head of the guitar, and there's a burnt spot there where I guess cigarettes have been stuck in that spot just under the bass string. While playing, you can just put your cigarette there. Eric Clapton used to do that too, didn't he? Famously. So you've got your patch of exposed wood there where you put your thumb, and Scott has told you that this is not good. But if it's good enough for Jaco Pastorius,
that's what I said. I said that to Scott actually. Yeah, it's as good enough for him. Yeah, because you learn all these things from Scott, and he's got all this, and obviously he's gone through it all, and there are good techniques and bad techniques. But you do see some very, very famous people where the thumb does creep over the neck, and it does sometimes. You know, Marcus Miller has his thumb over the neck very frequently, and you're not supposed to put the thumb over the neck. You're supposed to just, you know. But that my little finger has been redundant for quite a few years, so I'm strengthening that because I didn't use my little finger; I just used the others.
Yeah, some of those positions that you have to get your hand into, but yeah, Scott's very good at that. Spreading his finger across his hand across the fretboard, but yeah, it takes some work to get your fingers to actually have the strength to stretch all the way across and hit all the frets in the right way. Megan, it's been really interesting talking to you. Thank you so much for talking to me about all of these things that happened many years ago. It's been really interesting, and I'm also really happy that you're still playing the bass, especially taking lessons with Scott. And we're giving him even more free publicity at this point.
Yeah. Well, I do still play. I play at church when church is allowed to be open. And I play with a choir, the Life and Mission Choir. Unfortunately, it was their 20th anniversary last year. And at Easter, we were doing many great sort of concerts. We were doing Christian concerts. We were doing a thing called Time for Jesus, which was written by our leader, Paul. And, of course, everything was cancelled. At the moment, we're trying to do it online in time for Easter. But it's, a lot of things have been. And, of course, I haven't been playing live, in front of people. So Scott's bass lessons has saved me.
Didn't the Applejacks reunite a few years ago?
We reunited in 86 for the Bev Bevan from ELO put a concert together for the Children's Hospital in Birmingham at the NEC. It was called Heartbeat 86. So we got together for that. And then I think it was about 2016, 17, something like that. We got together because the church that I went to, where we frequently played, St. Mary's in Solihull, was in need of funds. And so we got together for that and had a concert actually in the church hall to raise money for them. And so they were exciting times. But more recently, there's a chap who's writing a book about the Applejacks. His name's Andrew. And he got us all together we did meet when Al was 70 and we all went down to Pembroke where he lives. So that was an occasion. But of course, Martin, the guitarist, has never been able to come to any of these things because he lives in California. So Andrew, this author who's doing the book, he got us all on Zoom, which meant that we were able to see Martin as well, which was fantastic after all these years. And Martin couldn't get his breath. So we were on Zoom, all six of us, and it was really super. And we really enjoyed it. And we decided that we were going to do it annually. We'll do it again in December next year because they were our university years, if you like. And they're special times. And it was odd, really, because I suppose Don and Martin were friends, but the rest of us, we weren't really friends. We were just sort of thrown together because of music. And interestingly, none of us actually joined that band because we were originally members of another band and we went to join. We were just mates who fell together thanks to the Boy Scouts.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we don't, we send Christmas cards to each other, but we're not in close contact. But we've just got that bond because we were together for all those years. And when I say together, we were sitting in the back of the van. That's the way it was those days. You had your gear in the back and you spent an awful lot of time, 24/7 it was. The first year that we spent with the Applejacks, we had 4 days off in the whole year. There was always a photo shoot or a recording session or an interview or a gig. There was always something because the agency, Harold Davison Agency, wanted to make money out of us. So,
There was no sort of acrimonious split then with the band. The band didn't split up in acrimony like many other bands do, when they've kind of reached their shelf life. the members of the bands will go their separate ways. And sometimes there's arguments and disagreements and falling out and stuff. Just think of a lot of other bands, you know, the Beatles are an example. So that didn't happen then really with you?
Well, when the singer left, he decided that he thought he'd do better on his own. So he just left and we weren't happy that he was leaving, but we just auditioned for somebody else and got somebody else in and carried on. And you see, we were doing these cruises, so we needed somebody. But it wasn't actually acrimonious. He just thought he'd do better as an individual, and so he left.
That's quite nice, quite refreshing. That it's just like, oh, I'm going to leave now. Okay, bye. And everyone's quite happy.
It was just like that. He got out the van one night and said, bye then, see you around. Yeah, okay.
Oh, that's nice. That's a refreshing version of the story instead of, you know, the usual kinds of fighting that we hear about in bands and stuff. Thank you again, Megan. And when we've managed to deal with COVID in a more organized manner, let's look forward to getting back on stage. You know, I hope you can be doing more shows and concerts and that you get all that practice with Scott's bass lessons is going to pay off.
I look forward to being in Paris again. We love Paris and we've seen you a couple of times there. We look forward to the time when we can come to another one of your presentations.
Yeah, that would be great. Absolutely. Okay. Well, say hi to the family from me.
Okay. I will.
And all the best. Thank you again.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Right, so that was Megan Davies from the Applejacks and from just normal life as well. Thanks again to Megan for taking the time to talk to us about all of that. This music you can hear in the background, that's another one of their songs. This one's called Baby Jane. Right, I'm going to stop playing that now. Can't play too much of that. But that was Baby Jane. I thought I'd play a little bit of Baby Jane at the end there. I think that Megan mentioned the song in that conversation, saying that she thought that was a better representation of what their music was really like, the sort of stuff that they played in their live shows. And you could hear Megan's bass guitar playing doom 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 doom. That sort of dance, more stuff you can dance to, more kind of R&B flavored rather than just the kind of more conventional pop of the other song, Tell Me When. So Baby Jane was the B-side to Tell Me When. But anyway, there you go. Thanks again to Megan for that. And it was very nice of her to give up her time and talk to us about things that happened in her life many years ago. And we really appreciate it. Now, you might be wondering why I didn't get Megan to actually play some bass for us, which would have been really nice, of course. But, I didn't really want to put her on the spot. And plus, for us to hear it, to actually hear the bass properly, she'd need to plug it into something like an amplifier and then connecting an electric guitar to a computer and playing the sound during a call is a bit tricky too. So it wasn't really possible at that particular moment. But you can hear songs by the Applejacks on Spotify and on YouTube. I'll be sharing some bits and pieces on the page for this episode, including a video filmed in 1964, I think, of Megan performing with the Applejacks, which is a great little sample of the time. And you can see her playing, I think, her Hofner semi-acoustic bass that she mentioned. So yes, we're pretty much done here. So it took me a few times to record the introduction to this episode, because I did actually record another introduction which I ended up not using. And the introduction I recorded first time round was like nearly 45 minutes long, which is obviously far too long. I couldn't publish that, because you'd be thinking, oh, Luke, get on with it, please. We just want to hear Megan as advertised in the title of the episode. So I couldn't publish that 45-minute introduction, but I feel reluctant to just delete it. So what I'm going to do with that introduction, the unused one, is I'll put it as bonus audio for this episode in the Luke's English Podcast app. So if you are listening using the Luke's English Podcast app, just have a look at the app there, and you'll see next to the play button, there should be a little gift icon. So if you touch the gift icon, that will reveal the bonus audio. And it's about 45 minutes of me rambling on about the Applejacks, about how I know Megan, about memories of going to college and playing music with her son Jake, and other things, and playing little bits of like The Shadows and some more. So it's about 45 minutes of that. So if you want to, you could listen to that, and it saves me from having to just delete it forever. So there you go then. All right, I'm curious to know what you think, everyone, as ever. So please do leave your comments in the comments section with any kinds of thoughts or questions that you have. And as I've said already, you know, check out the Applejacks music for a little flavour of the early to mid-60s in the UK. There you go. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, especially those of you who are still listening all the way to the end. You're the best. You are the best people. I mean, just generally, the best people in the world. You know, all those other losers who decided to stop listening to this. Oh, no. I mean, what's the point, really? I don't know. But oh, no, not you. You're still listening. Good for you. Well done. Give yourself a pat on the back. And I expect your English will, you know, will benefit all the more for your commitment and your interest as well. And there's nothing more for me to add here, except that I will speak to you soon in another episode of the podcast. But for now, it's just time for me to say goodbye. Bye, 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 bye. Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.